And to tell y'all more about that and her own story, which I'm real anxious to hear, I want you to meet Willie Dee from Spring, Texas. Well, I'll get undressed first. My name is Willie, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank the committee for having me here at Colorado Springs. And I want to promptly unthank the committee for making me wait till Sunday morning. It's been a beautiful convention. I have loved every minute of it up until right now. A lady asked me on my way up to the table here, "Are you nervous?" And I said, "No. I think every Sunday morning about this time." Somebody told me, come in with this notebook. They said, you had a prepared speech. I said, "No. In this notebook I have written down, my name is Willie and I am an alcoholic." I don't want to leave that out, and I have been known to do so. I want to tell you, basically, two things this morning. And I appreciate the privilege of telling you both. I want to tell you a little bit about what alcohol did to me. And I want to tell you a whole bunch about what AA has done for me. I have not found it necessary to take a drink, and this is a Texas tradition, since June the 19th, 1957. We laugh at my last birthday celebration. Did not many gals get a chance to be 16 twice. I tell you, I have enjoyed the second 16 better than I did the first, I think. I was born and raised in a little town of Spring, Texas. Now this bunch over here is laughing because they see up in North Carolina swears that I pronounce it Spring. And I say I don't. I say it in other traditions besides Texas as Spring. Now when I tell you that this is a little town, I mean that it is a little town. It is so small that we don't even have a village idiot. We all take turns. It's a little German community. All of us out there are kraut. Houston tries to claim now that they're moving out on us. We're about 16 miles out of Houston, north. And I found one man, God love his soul, he came to me and said, "I know where Spring is." But it's north of Houston, and Houston tries to claim that we're a suburb. And we always promptly tell them that they're a suburb of Spring. Because we were there first. A group of German brothers came over to this country and settled there because the water was good. My father and his family were among the original settlers. Good, staunch German Lutherans. I read so much in papers and periodicals and magazines about what alcoholics, what we're supposed to be. And I lose my cool sometimes when I read these articles written by lay people that tell us what we're supposed to be. In these 16 years, I have known thousands and thousands of alcoholics, and I have been privileged to know them all over the United States and in foreign countries. And I haven't been able to find any of them that I can put in these little egg crates like these lay writers do. It seems that they can just put us in these little pigeonholes. Alcoholics are, they say. And all of these alcoholics I've known, each one of us, we're so much alike, but we are different. My story is what I have to tell you. This little German community, everything out there was centered around the church and the school. The biggest thing that happened in spring was church picnic once a year. I can't go back, and when the psychiatrist was trying to help me go back, and say that anything in my childhood was traumatic, anything in my childhood caused me to drink. My family was neither rich nor poor. We were all in about the same bracket out there. We all farmed the good earth. I didn't hate my brothers. My brothers didn't hate me. None of these great, deep psychological things that so many of them want to say, aha, this is why you drank. I just grew up out there in that little German town. My dad made homebrew. Everybody made homebrew. And it was sort of like, if you watch the Waltons, it was sort of like the recipe. It was real good. Now, being German children, we were not, this just wasn't a thing. We were handed a glass of homebrew, the picnics or family gatherings or barn raisins. Heard somebody talk about barn raisins last night. These kind of things, we were all allowed to get us a little glass of homebrew. We weren't preached at or to about this. We did and went on about our playing and our square dancing. I graduated out of high school without too many bad things. Now, when I'm looking back, I can see that there were little streaks of being a rebel way back there. But this doesn't have to be all bad. But I got out of high school and went up to CSCW up at Denton, Texas, my first year of college. Then I went over to Southwestern and finished up in 1944. When I came home, if you'll note the year, when I came home, there was a war going on. And another one of the little signposts, I guess even then I had many hallucinations of grandeur. I came home and I told my good German papa that I was going to New York to be a model. Now, papa, he didn't know really exactly what a model was. But he had an idea. And he said no. And this was back in the days when Papa said no, he meant no. He said, you're not going to go to New York and you're not going to be a model. There's a war going on and your brothers are out there doing their part and you're going to do your part. Now, I had some ideas about what I could do for the war effort. But those weren't Papa's ideas either. He said, no, you have a college education, you have a degree. You're going into Houston, and you're going to teach school. Now, I thought, this is real Dullville to teach school. And when the psychologist and I tried to go back, he even examined that very carefully for a few minutes. Because many of the lay writers write that we're frustrated in our professions, we're frustrated in the jobs that we happen to fall into. But I hadn't been in that classroom 3 months till I knew that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I'm still doing it. This will be my 27th year at teach school, with a few little breaks here and there. I love the kids. I love fooling with them. I love everything about it. I have heard many of them say that all alcoholics have a very deep sense of inferiority, that they don't get along well with people, and this is one of the reasons why they drank. This is true in some instances. It was not true in mine, and maybe it's not true in yours. I have always liked people. Back in spring, we weren't ever taught any better. People never frightened me as such. I have never had a self-conscious bone in my body. I thought I was supposed to like everybody, and I did. I've always liked to be in crowds. I always liked to be into everything. I taught school in Houston, went out to the University of Houston at night, got my master's degree. And then they passed in Texas a bill called the Gilmer-Aiken Bill, which said that every teacher in the state of Texas had to go to college, if they hadn't gotten it already, and take practice teaching. So I chose a college that I had never been to, but it sounded like a lot of fun, up in San Marcos, Texas. And they had it was possible there to take practice teaching in the summertime. So I went up there and I took practice teaching. And I had my BA and I had my MA. And up there I got something real important, and that was my MRS. I met and married the man. Said, thank God, and I don't know why, but I'm still married to him. Now, a lot of people have said to me after I talked, there for a while, we didn't know whether you drank or not. Well, let me tell you, about here, the clock thickens a little bit. I married this man, and he was a United States Air Force officer. And I moved into a world that I had only read about in the books and the magazines and seen in the motion pictures. I had never been out of Texas to amount to anything. And he was stationed up at Scottsdale, Illinois. And he took me into this beautiful world. Traveling, officers' clubs, bars for the first time in my life. And for the first time in my life, I was introduced to these beautiful, beautiful mixed drinks. In all these pretty little glasses with these long stems and all that garbage in there, the oranges, the lemon peel, and they look so pretty, don't they? And I always liked pretty things. And I had been a good staunch beer drinker in Texas, and my husband laughs and says that this is one of the reasons. He had two good reasons for marrying me, he said. I could play baseball, and I could drink beer. I could hold a tremendous amount of beer and loved it. In Texas, it gets real hot. And I still can look at a good cold glass of beer when it's 110 in the shade, and it looks good. But I liked beer. I had always been able to hold a great amount of it. And I held this as a very particular point of pride. But when I got up there with the bars and the fancy little drinks in the little bitty glasses, I drank it just like I did my beer back in Texas. I had never sipped that beer, and I didn't sip those martinis. I loved it. I loved everything about it. I love a dark, smoky bar with a little combo sitting over in the corner, not really playing anything, just making noise. And I like all of the sophistication and the phony business that goes on. I love this. I like the officers' club. I like the fact that I felt like that I was living in a very glamorous world. We had been married for 2 years, and we had been sent down to Austin, Texas for my husband to finish up his master's at the university. And he got orders for Korea. He went to Korea. And later, the psychologist and myself, we tried to look at this part of my life and say, aha, here's where it is. There were a lot of wives that sat at home when their husbands went to Korea. A lot of wives. And they didn't drink booze like I did. I believe the big book when it says this is a progressive disease. Some of us progress faster than others. I have never done anything slowly in my life. He was gone 18 months, and I did a lot of lone drinking. Told the psychologist, I said, hell yeah, I did a lot of lone drinking. I wasn't about to drink with anybody, because my husband would have looked down on this. So I did a lot of lone drinking. I started by going up, so I went back to Houston, lived with my family, taught school, had a little apartment upstairs in their home. Then I started out taking a couple of beers upstairs when I would write his letter to him every night. And it progressed to a six-pack. And then those bottles got awful rattly, bringing them down the next morning. So I take up my half pint, and as the boy this morning said, I progressed, and I progressed very rapidly. When he came back from Korea, we knew something was wrong. The blackouts had started. I know what I started in on those letters. I'd read some of those letters that he brought back. They always started out real good. Towards the end, it was rather a problem to decipher them. We knew something was wrong, but it didn't occur to either one of us, big college graduates, that it was the booze. He couldn't understand why this woman that he had left behind was not a liar when he left here, and now I was. He could not understand why I was not a responsible person, the one he had left. He could not depend on me. If he said, pick me up at the flight line at 2:30, I might be there at 3:30. I might be there at 4:30, and I might not be there. He couldn't understand that. When the big book tells us that alcohol is cunning, and it's baffling, and it's powerful, if you knew out there, you believe it. You believe it. It doesn't make any difference what kind of person you've been, what kind of mind you have, what kind of morals you have. Booze can turn it upside down. And there's not one of us that's sitting here that will quarrel with that statement. We thought, well, and we started on what I like to refer to as the Golden Triangle. And many of you have been on this Golden Triangle. We figured there must be something wrong with me physically, although at this time I was just a little nervous, that's about all. But I thought, all right, maybe, you know, my gallbladder. Maybe it's my liver. Now booze, it never occurred to me that booze could have hurt any of this, but that just, you know, I hadn't been using myself to my full ability for 18 months, and so maybe all of these things had gone to pot. So we pick a very good doctor, and I go to him, and he examines me very thoroughly, sends us a big bill. And he tells my husband, and as my story goes on, you can tell everybody always talked to my husband. He told my husband, I have never seen a more perfect physical specimen in my life. He wouldn't pick out my gallbladder or my liver or something to be malfunctioning so I could say, uh-huh, that's where it is. So we coast along for a while, and you know things didn't get better. They didn't get better. So we go to the other point on the triangle, and I go to a nice little psychologist, and God love that man. I was the first alcoholic he had ever cruised with. I so often wanted to go back and see if he's still practicing. I was full blown by now in alcoholism, and I lied a lot. I lied an awful lot. I lied when there really wasn't any reason to lie. After three or four sessions with this man and delving into my past, he told my husband. And you know, it amazes me. And you think about it. I wanted so badly for this man to tell me that there was something wrong with me mentally. And you doubt the insanity of this program? I wanted him to put a label on me. I wanted him to say I was schizophrenic or, you know, some big long something that I couldn't even spell. Something that sounded good. Later on, I had a beautiful AA fellow tell me, well, I'll use the word psychotic. I wanted him, the psychiatrist, to tell me I was psychotic or some big something, you know, that would be socially acceptable to everybody. And he told me, he said, you know, when they said, there is a basic difference between a psychotic and a drunk. So the psychotic, he knows that 5 and 4 makes 10. Now an alcoholic or a drunk, he knows that 5 and 4 make 9, but he worries about it. I had another fellow later on to explain to me a little bit more about this psychotic being, but I hung around in AA and worried about why I was an alcoholic for so many years. But he told me, he said, now Willie just said this old AA story, and I like to pass it along to you people that want to find out, you know, all these mental hang-ups that you have, and that you're letting all this stand in your way. He said, the difference between a normal person and an alcoholic is the fact that they were in a room together and they needed to go out of the room, and there were 2 doors. And outside of 1 door, you could walk right on out and go on your way. And outside the other door, there was a man standing there with a baseball bat. And if you went out that door, he'd hit you in the head with that baseball bat. Now, the normal or the earth people, they would go out the door where they could just keep on walking. The alcoholic, he'd go out the door where the man was with the baseball bat that would hit him in the head. And if he wasn't there, the alcoholic would wait for him. But see, when I was busy trying to find out, and I wasted, oh dear God, people out there that are new, don't waste the time I did trying to find out why you're an alcoholic. Because I did. I piled up the heartache and the heartbreak that was so unnecessary. It doesn't make any difference why you became one. But in this searching, the psychiatrist told, or psychologist told my husband, said, are you sure that this girl is a college graduate? Because, see, I lied to this man too. Now, I was all right about pretty much just normal things, but don't let him get anywhere around my drinking or around what I had become, the lying, the cheating, the guilt, and the hurt. Knew I wouldn't give him the time of day about this. I even lied to this man about my age. Now look, that doesn't seem funny. I mean, it does seem funny when you think about it, because I told him I was older than I was. I've often thought how psychotic that really was. This didn't do any good because I didn't let it do any good. I wasn't ripe. I wasn't ready to even start being honest with myself. So how in the world could I be honest with anybody else? No way. There was only one other point left on that triangle as far as we were concerned, and that was spiritual help. I thought, well, I was raised a German Lutheran. It's a very strict religion. But it has always been comfortable. I didn't know any better. We didn't have any other churches in this town. So I had never been confused about religion. I only knew this one God. And even though it was a very strict religion as far as our behavior was concerned, we weren't threatened with God as a punisher. I couldn't see that I was too mixed up there, but I thought, well, being in the Air Force, being in the service, I had gone to more or less Protestant services. I had not really gone to church as often as I did when I was a youngster. And maybe this was the trouble. I talked with the little chaplain there, Protestant chaplain, and he was young. And I hope he's still among us someplace. Because he couldn't understand. He looked at me, I had an education. I had a beautiful husband. I had money. I was teaching, I was doing what I wanted to do. And of course this man asked me the one question that you have never asked me. Why, you think? Why? So I thought, I have never let anybody ask me a question. You know, there's nothing more smart aleck than a smart aleck school teacher. I have never let anybody ask me why and not give them some sort of an answer. So I gave the man all kinds of answers. None of them were true. But I had to make up some sort of an excuse for why I drank. One of the fellows was talking about our rationalizing things. And oh, goodness. You know, if I'd walk into a room and be standing there with a glass in my hand and somebody bumped me and I spilled it all over me, I'd say, I'm sorry. To them. They had spilled on me, but I always apologized to them. I rationalized everything that I did. Later on in AA, I heard this gorgeous story that took a little rationalizing out of me. And that was about the policeman that went to answer a fire alarm. And he got there, and they had pulled this old drunk out of this burning building. And he grabbed the old drunk and shook him a couple of times, and he said, "Hasn't anybody ever told you not to smoke in bed? You set the bed on fire." And the old drunk said, "It was on fire when I got in it." I never wanted to be wrong. That's another little hang-up that you might have, that it's so nice when you get rid of it. I sort of like the businessman. He never did want to be wrong. And he had an advertising promotion deal going, and he needed a mongoose. Well, he needed his secretary to write the letter. And at the last minute, he decided that he needed more than one mongoose. Well, he didn't want to appear ignorant to his secretary. He didn't know whether you said mongooses or mongeese or what. So he dictated the letter to her, and he asked this animal place to send him one mongoose. And while you're at it, send me another one. I didn't like to be wrong. And I didn't like to get into a situation where I couldn't rationalize myself out of it. But see, at that time, I didn't know all these things. It was you people that helped me with all those things. I don't have to tell you all the things that happened to me. You know how destructive they were. I envy you men sometimes. You can get along so long and drink. Because you're funny sometimes when you drink. You're funny. You put on lampshades and you get on the table and you can dance and everything and you're funny. But let me tell you something. You ever seen a funny woman drunk? No way. Have you ever seen cartoons about a woman drunk? Mm-mm. It's always the man hanging on the lamppost. We're not funny. There's something so degrading and so hurtful. Not a woman drunk. You men put us way up there on that pedestal. And dear God, I don't believe woman's lib or anything's ever going to change this. You put us up there. And when we drunk, we can't stay up there. It got bad when we were stationed in Omaha, Nebraska. General Curtis LeMay was there at the time. It was a very strict run base. Stack bases usually are. And my husband had gotten, I thought, and he thought, just about as far as he could go with me. He knew that something had to be done. And while he was drinking in the officers' club one night alone, I was home doing my drinking because he didn't want me to go to the club very much anymore. An Air Force nurse, and I never have liked Air Force nurses since, but she suggested to him that I probably had a deep mental problem, but being that I had been through the psychiatry vet, that maybe Alcoholics Anonymous could help me. That maybe I was an alcoholic. Now, I'm sure, see, she suggested other things wrong with me. Because this man is fine looking. But he thought about this, and he thought, all right, maybe this does make sense. I don't know much about alcoholism and an alcoholic. So he called a central office in Omaha, Nebraska, and a great big gal named Mary was up there answering the phone. And she asked him, said, does she want help? And he said, uh-uh. I won't help. This man's finding, this was his career, and I was blowing it. And he needed help. Mary said, well, she probably will not come to a meeting. He had told her several little things about me by this time. But she said, the only way we can get on the base is to break her anonymity, because we have to fill out a form in order to get on the base to see her, and we have to state why. General LeMay was real picky about this sort of thing. And she asked if he would like for him to do that, for her to do that, and he said no. Was there anything else she could do for him? And he asked her, after she told him about the big book, to send him one, and she did. And he read the big book. Now, he suggested that I read it. I didn't want to, because the word alcoholic was on it. I didn't really object to the anonymous bet. It was the word alcoholic that threw me. And I didn't want to read this book. Well, you know, it's funny, and I know a lot of you fellows and a lot of you gals have been through with this. There was only one book, and it just sent one. That book was all over those quarters. In the bathroom, I'd go in there, there was the book. I'd go in the kitchen, there was the book. Everywhere he left that book. I didn't touch it, except to move it around a little bit. I'd put it in the drawer, he'd take it out of the drawer. It made sense to him, because when he read this book, then he really did say, aha, this is what's wrong here. But he also read it very carefully. He's a very careful man. He read it very carefully. And he knew that there was no way to force me to do this thing. And I was going down and down and down. Now, finally, we get sort of saturated with booze, but we're not real stupid. I knew that I couldn't hold on to this man very much longer if I didn't do something, even if it was wrong. So I agreed, after one particularly bad bout, that I would go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if he wanted me to so bad. So I got in the car and I drove into Omaha one night and attended a meeting. I came home and I was absolutely enthralled. I told my husband, that's the finest bunch of people I ever saw in my life. But oh my God, they had lots of problems. I told him, I said, honey, do you know that some of those women have been in jail? Do you know that some of those people have been in hospitals because of their drinking? And they're fine people, I said, they're dressed nice. And I just don't understand how they made such a mess out of their life. And somebody was talking about being phony. Doc, I think it was. If you gave a prize for being phony, I'd get it. I was so phony, though, that like you, like many of you, I didn't know I was phony. But I made a big deal out of how nice the people were and how unfortunate they were that they had gotten into all this trouble with their drinking. And here's what I did. I did what a lot of my teenagers do today in my classroom. They sit in my classroom day after day, and they look me right in the eyeball when I'm talking. And they hear me, but they don't listen to a word I say. I ask them, I say, listen, listen. They say, we hear you, we hear you. They hear me talking. And they say, they see my mouth moving. But they don't listen, and this is what I did to you. I heard everything you said, but I didn't really listen and apply anything that you said. We were stationed two different places in Illinois, in Grantoul. I went up to Haxton, Illinois to meetings. I had a good excuse there not to do anything really constructive because I was the only woman in the group. Now, I love to go to groups, but I'm the only woman in the group. But I explained to my husband that's why I couldn't stay sober. See, it took you to explain what it was, the difference between a periodic drinker and a daily drinker. I was not a daily drinker. I did not have to have a drink every day. I have not lost a job. I went to my classroom every... And that reminds me of a story about this poor old school teacher was so hungover. Oh, merciful heavens. And when somebody in AA told me this story, I dearly loved it. Said she was so hungover, and she got to class, and the kids were particularly noisy that day, and she thought, oh, Lord, I can't stand this. I'll give them a writing assignment. So she told him, said, now I want you to make up a story. And she figured she'd make it as hard as she could for him. So she said, I want you to include these three things, religion, and a little sex, and mystery. She said, doll, I'll hold him for at least 30 minutes. So she sort of propped her head in her hand and was going to rest a little while. And little Henry, way in the back, jumped up, waved his hand, and finally she tried to ignore him, but he kept waving. She said, all right, Henry, what do you want? He said, I'm through. She said, oh, now, come on, you couldn't possibly be through. He said, I'm through. She said, did you include religion and sex and mystery in your story? He said, yes, ma'am. She said, all right, read it out loud to everybody. And he got up and he read, Dear Lord, the princess is pregnant. Who done it? That was a lot like a lot of my mornings. They didn't turn out like I planned them. We moved those first three or four years, and of course later, as the time was accruing, and I wasn't, I would go for 3 and 4 months maybe without drinking, and then off. No reason. No reason that I could put my finger on. I would just take that first drink. Because, see, I wasn't doing anything not to take that first drink. I was hearing you. You were telling me all kinds of things. You were telling me about being honest. I had never stolen anything in my life that I knew about. I had never written a bad check. I felt like an old gal, and I got real put out with that old gal. Later, working with her in Seattle, we were coming home from a meeting, and I had worked hard with this old gal trying to get her straightened up and get her to that meeting. And on the way home, she said, Willie, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And I said, oh. And she said, no, she said, you know, those people every night were talking about hiding bottles. And I don't hide bottles. I thought to myself, hell no, you live in an apartment by yourself. But everything you told me, I would find an excuse why it didn't apply to me. You told me about honesty, and I know you said self-honesty. I know you did, but see, I wasn't listening real good. But I'll tell you something. If you've been hanging around and you can't put this thing all together, you keep hanging around, because God will do the same thing for you he did for me. He's going to slip all this stuff, one little piece at a time. He's going to slip it in your pocket like he did for me. Everything that I ever heard, he put in my pocket. He knew that one of these days, Willie's going to clean out all those pockets. And everything she's ever heard in every AA meeting, from every AA speaker, from every person that tried to help her, it'll be there. It doesn't go away. This is what we really mean when we tell you we're going to spoil your drinking. All these little things are right there. And God has this plan. And when you need it, you're going to get it. I never forgot anything. I messed around and fooled around in this program for 4 years. You people tried so hard to help me. And oh, when somebody walks in the club now and poor thing, and they sit there and I hear some little simp over in the corner say, too far gone. Can't help her. I think, oh God, I know there's sound of them some people between Omaha and Seattle that gave up on me. You better believe I, but nobody ever let me know that. They told me they loved me. They knew I was phony. They didn't tell me that. They just said they loved me. And that when I got ready to do something about my drinking, they'd be there. They never told me to go and not come back. They tried to show me along the way what I was doing wrong, but they didn't cram it down my throat because they knew that there was so much coming out that there was no way to put anything in. And I think the old timers, God bless their hearts, they knew that old Willie was going to have to take a beating. And God did too. He knew that it was going to take a lot to bring me to my knees. And he went about it very methodically. I listened to these women talk about being in jail, and I looked down my nose. I listened to them talk about being in hospitals, and I looked down my nose. And the old timers told me, Willie, there's no place to go with this booze except down. When I mean said, have you ever, ever seen a liquor sign on a liquor store that pointed up? They always point down. Notice, 99 out of 100 points down. And you drinking whiskey?
Coat style, you know, collar turned up, great big wide belt about this wide.
And that's all. And a smile on my face. I sat in that drunk tank that night and I thought, oh dear God, no, no. I'll never take another drink of whiskey as long as I live. And you know, you alcoholics know, I meant that. I meant it with everything in me. This was the most degrading thing that I thought could ever happen to me. They let me out of jail, and I got a cab and started home. And I was so sincere about this pledge that I had made in jail that I stopped on the way home and got sick. So see, I was lacking in sincerity even then. But at least I went back to AA. I never quit going. And these people never really lost patience with me. An old gal named Helen out there in Seattle told me, said, you know, hell, you are so bull-headed, honey. Oh, you are bull-headed. But she said, God, I hope to live to see the day when you take that bull-headedness and that stubbornness and turn it the other way. And really then, I didn't know what she's talking about. But that's one of the ways I stay sober. Ain't nobody gonna get me drunk except me. I can be just as stubborn about staying drunk, about staying sober, as I was about staying drunk. I can take that trait in my basic character and turn it into something useful. You taught me that. Now, somehow, with this phoniness, I stayed sober for about a year in Seattle, beginning in 67. And God stepped down and did something else for me. I had been married 10 years. And God stepped in and gave me a beautiful baby boy. I took this baby and we were transferred down to Montgomery, Alabama. I got to Montgomery sober, with a year behind me. And I was physically sober, but mentally I had never really dried out good. I was so wrapped up in me, and God sent me right where I needed to go, Alabama, and particularly Montgomery. Those people
helped put it together for me. They helped me take out of my pocket everything that had ever been put in there by people all over the country. I bellyached and moaned and groaned, even out there in Seattle. And I remember at one meeting one night, I said, you know, you people just, you really put me off. He's telling me about not drinking and that I ought not to drink and all this stuff. And I said, you men, you got it made. You sober up and your wife gets out even the vanilla extract out of the kitchen. She gets all the booze out of the house. And she doesn't drink anyhow very much. And she helps you every step of the way. I said, I got a hard, two-fisted drinker that I'm married to. And this stoop-up and ran to little Noah that was in AA told him when Cy asked him, said, Buzz, will it help her really if I quit drinking? And if I ever get back to Rantoo, I'm going to kill him because he told Cy, uh-uh. He said, if Willie ever gets ready to quit drinking, it won't make any difference whether you drink or not. I'm going to kill him if I ever find him again. Cy, being a military man, he took him at his word. And he drinks a lot. And I told him out there in Seattle, I was carrying on one night, and I said, you know, it's just so easy for you men, because your wives quit drinking, and even if they did take a little eggnog at Christmas, they won't even do this to help you out. But I said, here this man drinks every single day in front of me. I try to cook a meal. I have to move the whiskey bottle, $50, $60, $80 worth of liquor there in my kitchen cabinet. How in the world do you expect me to quit drinking? And a big old guy out there named Swede said, well, I'm going to tell you something. He said, I drive a beer truck. In and out of these taverns all day long. And he said, a lot of people have asked me, they say, Swede, how you stay sober for 9 years driving this beer truck and going in and out of these taverns and everything. And Swede said, I always tell them, hell, if I drove a garbage truck, I wouldn't eat the garbage truck. Every time I look at a bottle of booze, I see garbage written on there. I put that in my pocket, but I wasn't ready yet for me to really pin down and accept what you told me. I was carrying on, and in the Montgomery, I had this tiny baby, and my husband would go out and bore holes in the sky all day, and he'd come home, and he was tired. And he would shake up that shaker of martinis, and that ice sounded good, even. And I'd tell him, I'd say, now, look, I'm trying to do what these AA people tell me to do. I can't drink. I can't take a pill. And I am so nervous. And you come home and you shake up those martinis and I sit there and I watch that tiredness roll off of you and I've been messing with this baby. I don't know anything about babies. I've been messing with this baby all day and I'm so nervous. You know, when God gets ready to help you, he helps you every which way. This man looked me right in the eye and he said, hell, just be nervous. Thing he could ever done for me. I haven't taken a mood-changing drug in these 16 years. I'm just nervous. He has lived to regret the day that he told me to just be nervous. Because it made sense to me and I thought that was a good idea. So a lot of mornings I get up and I tell him, I am nervous today. All day long. Now see what I did? I took one of my problems, I gave it to him. He can't fuss too much because it's his idea. And I got to thinking about that very simple remark. Just be nervous. And I thought to myself, well, hell, you know, and I bet you in medical history there never has been anybody that shook to death. At my age and state of servitude now, I wake up some mornings, I'm pretty nervous. Sometimes I'm so nervous I can thread a sewing machine and hit the running. But you have taught me that that's all right, see? That's all right. I try to think of all the good things now that I get out of things. I've never had to go to Slender Bollock. I think I'll shake it off. I still had a lot of hang-ups to go. The big one was the fact that I resented this man drinking every day in front of me. I resented it. And no matter what she tried, you tried. I read the big book. I did everything trying to get rid of this resentment. And I was all right till I'd hear the martini shaker going. And then the whole thing would fly out the window. I didn't think it was right. I had done him the favor of sobering up. And why then could he sit? Or how could he do this to me? Sit and drink in front of me. Now this creates a lot of these other problems that we've been talking about here in this. Yeah. It's hard to do a lot of things cold sober with a half-bombed partner. Dancing, things like that. All kinds of things. And I resented it, and I could not let go of this resentment. And it was like a wall standing there in front of me. And yet I knew this man well enough. When he told me, alcoholism, my dear, is your problem. It is not my problem. I didn't marry you to affect your problems. See, this man is an adult, and I wasn't yet. It took you to teach me how to grow and be an adult, but he was. He said, that's your problem. You solve it. I enjoy drinking, and that's what I intend to do. Now, I've had a lot of trouble getting this man, and I wasn't about to, you know, just throw him out the window. But I also was getting serious enough, and I was beginning to hear enough from you where I wanted to stay sober, too. And I sought out those old-timers in Montgomery, and I got a hell of a lot of help. The main thing was acceptance. I would not accept the things that I could not change, and I could not change this man. His drinking or anything else. And if I wanted to stay sober, I had to change my attitude, and I had to accept this thing you kept telling me. And old Charlie A. there in Montgomery, God love him, he's dead now, but he did a lot for me by appealing to a sense that I had that he knew I had, and that was my sense of humor. And he told me, he said, Willie, acceptance is not the big deal. You're trying to make it something deep and profound and all this. And he said, it's not, honey. He said, you take that serenity prayer and try to live by it, but quit screwing it up. Quit making it so deep and so profound. All of that deepness and all of that profundity and all of those books you had read in college, they didn't do you any good. Willie, get this thing simple. And he said, you remind me so much of what we went through here in the highway department when we were trying to break in men to drive these great big diesel trucks that were coming in with this power behind them. And he said, we decided that they didn't only need a road test to drive these things, they needed a psychological test. They needed to see if, we needed to see if they were emotionally fit to drive these big trucks. So we contrived this test, and he said, this old boy was in, he had passed his driver's test, and he was taking his psychological test. And said, the man was talking to him, and he asked him, he said, now, if you were coming down this real steep hill, and it had been raining, and that road was wrecked, and you were carrying a great big load, and you got down to the bottom of that hill and there was a curve there, and you put on the brakes and there wasn't any brakes, what would you do? And the old boy sat there a minute and he said, well, but I'd wake up Leroy. And the man thought, well, that's, you know, if this shows now that he's concerned about his partner, and this shows that, but I want him to put it into words. And he said, well, why would you wake up Leroy? And he said, well, Leroy, he ain't never seen a great big wreck.
old timer today, he was trying to tell me, Willie, this man's gonna drink. And you don't want to drink. So the best thing to do is accept his drinking. I thought a little further in the old timers because I still couldn't wear this comfortably. And my beautiful, beautiful Rose in Montgomery, Alabama took me out to lunch one day. And I was moaning and carrying on about fire drinking. And now understand, please understand me now, right now. This man is not an alcoholic. He's the social drinker. He is a heavy drinker, but what I guess is a social drinker. But he's a disgusting kind of drinker. He can drink three or four drinks, and then he eats. A lot of things. He's a heavy eater. He eats, and then he'll do something like go get a bowl of ice cream or a piece of pie. And then he goes to bed. Now, isn't that disgusting? And I hate to watch him do that successfully every day. He's not up at 3 o'clock in the morning, prowling around looking for a drink. Rose said, Willie, I believe there's a way out of this thing. And she said, you have a sense of humor. Why don't you use it? Why don't you use it? It saves more alcoholics than any other one single thing except being close to God. And she said, what makes you think that God doesn't want you to have sense of humor? Because God does. And she said, instead of moaning and groaning and bellyaching, why don't you get your sense of humor out and polish it off and undo this man? Well, I gave this some thought. I have been ruining every Sunday. Because, you know, even these social drinkers, these control drinkers, they lose control every once in a while. And when he'd get particularly bombed on Saturday night, I'd pout all day Sunday. Silent treatment. I'd pout all day Sunday. I'd ruin my Sunday, what I'd do. For myself and my boy. And Rose said, honey, there's a way out of that. You just put your mind to thinking. So I did. Well, I waited carefully until he got real bombed one Saturday night. And I woke up Sunday morning. My husband doesn't like country western music. I love it. And in Alabama, you get lots of it. The first thing I did that Sunday morning is turn on the country western loud. Loud. And then when I heard him stirring around in there, I went and fixed his breakfast. My husband doesn't like fried eggs. He likes his eggs scrambled. That Sunday morning, I fried those eggs. Just barely. And when I put them down in front of him, I shook them a little bit. When that wore off, I got where I put a little green food coloring on. He would sit there, God loving, and try to eat them. And I would sing loud to the country music. And I started having fun with this man. He doesn't know what I'm going to do to him now. I thought of all kinds of little goodies. See, when I removed myself from the center of this problem, and made him the center of it. I got going, coaches. My boy was about 9 years old and he came in and see, even my boy was helping me, didn't know it. But he came in and he said, Mama, Ricky down the street has a new pet. And he said, I sure would like to have one. And of course I thought in terms of a hamster or a gerbil or something like that. And I said, well, sure, honey. And he said, well, Mama, it's a snake. And I told you I'm a country girl. I had taught science along the way because that's my minor.
and snakes didn't bother me a bit. And when he said that, the light bulb went off. My husband can't stand snakes. He is scared to death of snakes. I said, sure, honey, we'll go Saturday and get one. We went down to the pet store and we got a long black king snake. And we named him Jack. When my husband gets bombed, I open the bedroom door and I put old Jack in there and close the door. Then he wakes up. God meant for me to use this sense of humor. He meant for me to do anything you told me to stay sober. And this is what I have done. This has been a happy 16 years. Now, I don't mean only an idiot's happy all the time. I don't mean that kind of a happy. Happiness is. It's affecting all sorts of things and making something out of them. Nothing is intended to just be there. Do something with it. A lot of problems, when you remove yourself from the middle of them, they become so small. As the man said in Montgomery 2, Willie, you are so filled with your own self-importance. He said, why don't you do one of the things that we advise people to do down here in the South? Why don't you fill up a bucket of water and stick your thumb in it? And pull it out and see what a hole it made. And this is one way for you to sort of forget your self-importance. I haven't said much about the spiritual side of this program. You know. I don't have to tell you. If it wasn't for God following me every step of this way and holding my hand, I wouldn't be here. You know that. And you know that my whole life is centered. I always knew, I thought that I knew a lot about God. You taught me that I needed to know God. You taught me that when I picked up that phone and rang God, it helped me. That even when I didn't get an answer, or when I got a busy signal, don't hang up. You told me don't hang up. You told me to have patience, and I became angry when all I had was people that worried the hell out of me. But see, this is the way that God had of given me patience. Anybody can have patience that don't have people bothering them. I prayed for tolerance, and God gave me deplorable situations. My boy's a teenager now. Can you imagine having a teenager my age? This is a happening around our house. Every day is a happening. He rides a motorcycle. I decided, well, there was one way to fight this. I got a motorcycle. My husband doesn't ride motorcycles. My boy and I get up on Sunday morning, burn. Gets him out of bed too. Along the way, God has been good enough to me to let me do a lot of 12-step work. I'm still teaching. But I found that I never give an excuse for not going on 12-step. Because an old gal in Seattle told me, when I told her one night that I was too tired to go on a 12-step call, she said, with it, she'll get too tired to get drunk. God has been good to me. A lot of people have asked me,
that I'm working with. Just what is AA? New people and Al-Anon, that when we get there, they want to know, what is AA? And I want to finish up by telling you a little bit of a story. When I was in Alabama, after I got my feet out of midair and got them on the ground and began to really seriously do something about myself and quit trying to do anything about everybody else, I was privileged to work with Rose out at Julia Cutwiler Prison for the 3 years that we were stationed there. And I have told those girls so many times when I'm talking to them, in a way, you're lucky. I'm going to go home tonight, and I'm going to climb that door behind me and get in my car, and I'll go home, and you're going to stay here. But in a lot of ways, some of you are luckier than I am. You know what you did. You know what you did. I don't know. I don't really know whether I ever hit anybody in that automobile. I know that there were many a mile that I drove that thing, and I didn't remember. I don't know whether I killed somebody. I don't know whether I hurt somebody. Doc said the other night, you can't be grateful for what you have. Be grateful for what you escaped. A little dentist up in North Carolina, when I was speaking up there one time, he talked right after I did, and he said, people, if you can't think of any way other things to be grateful for, be grateful for you that you're not married to Willie. We had a little old lady come in one time, and she was just, you know, her life had just been shot all to hell, and she was so down in the mouth about it. And she said, what do you mean? I've lost my husband, I've lost my children, I've lost all of the money that I ever had. I have reach this bottom, and you tell me to be grateful. And she said, what do I have to be grateful for? And one of the old-timers, one of the hard noses, switched his cigar from one side to the other of his mouth, and he said, hell, you can be grateful that wrinkles don't hurt. Is my heart expanding drug? My young people tell me about the mind expanding drugs. We got something here. We got a heart expanding drug. And I'm on it. I am hooked. And I love it. While we were waiting one night, there had been a disturbance in the prison, and we were having to wait. And there were a whole bunch of old grapevines sitting out there, and I was thumbing through them. And my specialty in my profession is reading, and it's speed reading, and I sped through this little thing in the grapevine. It was about a 1956, and when they told us we could go in, I threw it down, and I got home that night, and I got to thinking about what this thing had said. I got up out of bed, and I got my pencil and paper, and I wrote down as nearly as I could remember, and it just simply said, what is AA? I want to pass this on to you. It said, AA is a spirit. It cannot be touched, nor can it be completely understood. It's as wide as the world, and yet it's small enough to fit snugly into the heart and the mind of man. It has brought light where only darkness dwelt. It's given hope to the hopeless, and help to those who yearned in despair. It has nourished forgiveness in those who knew no pity. It's given strength to the weak and humility to the strong. It has spurred to higher goals those who strove for nothing. It has taught patience to the hurried and action to the lazy. To youth, it's given vision, and to the aged, promise. To the lonely, companions, and to the restless, rest. To the sick, it's been a doctor, and to the dying, it has revived the desire to live. It has no judgment against the unteachables, nor has it praise for those who learn. To the outcast, it's been a family. To the childless, it's given children. To the ignorant, wisdom, and to the wise, tolerance. it has given to all men that which is most precious. It's given a love for truth with enough left over to share with each other. Thank you for having me.
Would you all join hands and we'll close this convention with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, deliver us from evil.